Welcome to Sterile Packaging on Track Radio. This podcast delivers insights on medical device packaging, from regulatory affairs, process management, as well as discussions on the latest in sterile device packaging technologies. Each episode, our host Charlie Webb speaks with global experts to bring the most relevant information to our esteemed listeners. As sterile packaging compliance becomes increasingly more challenging, it is vital to avoid information gaps that could risk your medical device packaging program. Avoid package failure risks and build your skill set from your colleagues' experience and from insights from sterile device packaging subject matter experts.
This is Charlie Webb, and you're listening to Sterile Packaging on Track Radio. Spot radio, as we're known to many. Well, today we wanted to talk about just kind of a hodgepodge of things centered around medical device package testing. So I wanted to bring in, as I always try to do around here, bring in the big guns. I brought in a friend of mine, Lon Goldbaum. You probably know Lon. He works with Network Partners. He's the Vice President of Packaging Engineering and Client Solutions there. Very bright guy. I always enjoy bellying up to the bar and chatting with him each year at the Medical Device Packaging Technical Committee, little meetup that we have over there at the Marriott when the MD&M is going on. But we want to touch on a few things. You know, he has a kind of a pet peeve, and I share this one about medical device package testing validation. I think a lot of people are using systems that they didn't validate. And if you're using a test methodology and it has no girth to it, then obviously it's going to be thrown out, something that has to be reviewed. And we're going to touch on that a little bit. We'll also chat about, which we had before, the 1 pound urban legend and where that came from and why we continue to seem to use it. It just never goes away. Well, Lon, thanks for hanging out with me today. It is a pleasure, as always, having you here with me. How you doing?
Doing well. Thanks for the invite, Charlie. Appreciate it.
Well, thanks for coming out. You know, today I don't have any sort of scheduled discussion in place. You and I talk about testing. So maybe let's start out. What are all the cool kids doing these days? I know we're destructive testing is still kind of the mode of choice for in-process testing. Is that still what you're seeing?
Yeah, I mean, it's still what I'm hearing from my team. And, I have 60 engineers supporting all sorts of clients across the country here. And the way I'm used to doing it, which I'm sure it's changed, since 2006, of course, do you really need to do destructive testing for in-process monitoring? And what comes to mind as it relates to packaging engineering is what are you really destructive testing here is really peel testing is what I'm thinking about. And that's really just ensuring that your process is still in control and capable of what it was set to do and how it was validated to begin with.
Yeah. I mean, I think what we're looking at when, obviously, I probably have a skewed viewpoint since we're in the business of selling and propagating medical device packaging testing systems.
Yeah. But
what we're finding is, at the end of the year, everything becomes much more crystal clear when you're in the middle of an audit and you're trying to understand through some sort of metric, were we getting good seals throughout the year? I mean, people are going in these long, month-long sort of pauses in between doing really any kind of relevant testing. The risk of that is so high. And if the tests are done properly, regularly, I think they have a lot of value. I mean, do you still feel that way?
Yeah, they're always going to be additive to what you're doing. I think the key for me is from the point that you release the equipment into the manufacturing floor and you're building product off that or creating that final seal in the package, is it still doing what it's supposed to be doing? Because I've been in situations where, you do this full-blown validation, maybe you're testing 298 samples or 598, whatever your risk analysis tells you to test in severity. Is the process still in control and capable at the end of the day? And do you really need to do destructive testing to prove that out? And I think in some cases you do from, again, peel testing, which really, if you think about it, peel testing under ASTM F88, it's really going to tell you if your process is still in control on a daily basis or depending on how you do your statistical process control.
Mm-hmm.
There's other types of tests that are involved, visual inspections. Again, I don't think that's really destructive there. Seal width measurements don't have to be destructive as well. So if you go into this process validation and you look at everything, you look at all the risks and you validate to those risks and to those severity levels, then releasing it to the manufacturing floor for use should just be an upkeep in a sense. It really should just be collecting data on a daily basis and just plotting that on your control charts. And really, that's just going to tell you if your process is is really doing what it was meant to do under the validation status.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think where a lot of engineers are finding value, packaging engineers, is that, you know, we'll develop these on the headwater of a validation. We have a lot of great minds coming together. A lot of everyone is a degreed engineer. They have experience. And so as it sort of goes down the food chain into the clean room, we have, you know, more less in service people that are involved with the packaging, and they may not be seeing the process through the same optic that we're looking at. So I think where we're seeing value is that, you know, we're trying to preserve what we developed in our validation, and we're really blind to the process unless we have some sort of metric to feed back into that loop. And I think some of the problems that we were seeing 5 or 6 years ago, which kind of incited us to do more testing, is where we were finding out, you know, 6 months in to our validation, we find out through a customer or a device dropping through the bottom of the closure side of a seal. And we're like, huh, that's interesting. So we never want our customers to be doing our quality assurance. And I think that's obviously the danger of a non-sterile device. And so I think the value is that, you know, we're bracketing, if we're in a packaging audit, you know, how do we look at the auditor and say, okay, well, how did you know what happened on Thursday at 6 o'clock? I mean, so the new sort of value that we're seeing is a lot of medical device manufacturers are testing in the morning, middle of the day, and at the end of the day, so they can bracket the process to make sure there's no gross failures on that closure side of the seal. And I guess that's where the value is, considering that, you know, 3 or 4 minutes, if you streamline the process to do it, I guess, you know, the feeling is that why not?
Yeah. And that's also a new approach too, because the way I've kind of grown up in the industry and seen the way it's done on the floor is, and there's no rhyme or reason to it, right? It's like, all right, every work order, every batch order that you're going to manufacture on the floor, I'm going to pull 3 test samples at the beginning of the run, and I'm going to pull 3 test samples at the end of the run, statistically analyze it to make sure it's above your minimum specification, you know, call it your minimum peel strength spec, for example, and then plot it if you can, and then everything's good because you have your outer and lower alarm limits, your control limits, and you're plotting the data in between that just to make sure that everything's fine. Now, again, I've seen people do it differently all sorts of ways. And as long as you're collecting the data and you're using that data, applying it somehow to make sure, and it's, I guess, a statistical approach, it's just really going to help you ensure that your process is still, it's still working the way you intended it to when you released it to the floor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think, you know, we were having problems. And I think sometimes maybe this is why people were sort of soured on peel testing, because they weren't holding to the ASTM F88. So the M15, wherever we are now on that standard, what they were doing, I mean, we talk about the Dick's Sporting Good approach where companies were going to a sporting goods store, they were grabbing a 1 pound weight, they were getting some little alligator clips attaching to it. And so if the weight hits the ground, then they have a bad seal. I mean, literally that's how scientific some of these were. And even companies who think that they're doing the test correctly, you know, I manage 2 17025 accredited laboratories, and I'm audited on those as part of our surveillance. And, you know, if you don't follow that process the correct way, then obviously you're going to get skewed data. I mean, we even use a loading tool to make sure that we get the specimen equally into the fixture. We're pulling it apart per the ASTM standard. So I think when it's done wrong, I guess you could apply this to anything. If you're not doing it correctly, then obviously you're going to be soured on the process. But done correctly and using, you know, a loading tool like we do, because they found that, you know, I've heard as much as 30% variance between users based on user behavior when they're loading fixtures. And so we can't have, you know, that human change. So given that we have a way to sort of bracket and then codify the process to make sure that it's done correctly, I believe there's a great deal of value, because as packaging engineers, often we're moved on to other issues. And sometimes we forget what's happening. And so many things that are happening on the machine side or the human side, there's a change that we didn't even predict when we were doing our original validation. This is particularly true for startups. They were surprised that something happened at 2 o'clock in the morning with a night shift, and they didn't expect whatever those, you know, a drop in air pressure for devices that are, you know, create pressure through air. So there's a lot of changes that can take place, and we got to be able to make sure that the validation that we beautifully created to make sure that that device stays sterile is staying intact through some sort of gating.
Yeah. I mean, I've seen a couple, here's a couple examples that I've seen in that I've had to actually manage or kind of work through. You know, one, going back to, you know, the validation of a test, or you know, even call it PEEL testing, and you have different operators, you get different results. A big overlook that I see is sometimes a lot of people just accept it on its own, but they don't do the test method validation portion of it. It's like, oh, it's a published standard. We're just going to go ahead and use it.
That's right.
And, you know, keep in mind, ISO 11607, it's pretty much in black and white there. It tells you all TMVs must be validated prior to use. Otherwise, you don't know. You could have, a bunch of different people doing this test. Yeah, you're going to get a wide array of data. It's not going to be the same. So, you know, once you do the gauge R&R, you know, you create your defects and, you know, people can identify those and you have a proper training process. Mm-hmm. That's kind of like helping on the front end to make sure everything's good. You know, another instance is I was called into the manufacturing floor. I was sitting in a meeting and we had the sealer. It was validated. And they said, well, the peel strength dropped off. And there's a couple things associated with that. One is this fictitious 1 pound spec, if you want to get into that, because I love talking about that. I've had some issues around that too. But the peel strength dropped off. And I said, okay, well, tell me what changed. And they're like, well, nothing changed. You know, it was fine on Tuesday, and on Wednesday, it's not working. I'm like, all right. So to your point, something must have happened overnight to really, you know, affect the line, impact what was going on. So one thing I always tell my engineers and train people on is always trust but verify. If you can go to Gamba, walk the floor, check it out, see what's up. Because, you know, one person's perception of what's happening is going to be completely different from yourself as an expert and as an SME in package engineering. So, you know, go down there and walk the floor. And I'm looking around. I'm like, so you guys moved the sealer, huh? And they're like, yeah, but we just moved it to this table. And I said, okay, you know, I see that. And then again, explain to me, like, the sealer was on the table, right on the table before, and now it's on 2 2x4s. It's propped up, you know, and again, trust but verify, right? You know, they only know what they know. So you go down there, you walk the floor, and then I'm looking at this. I'm like, so why did we do that? They wanted to create an underpass for the sterile barrier systems to slide through to make it easier for the operators. You know, people really didn't take into account what the impact is on a sealer. And if you think about a sealer, it's a critical piece of equipment, manufacturing equipment, packaging equipment, because it makes that terminal seal before everything gets final package and sterilized. Mm-hmm. So that is a very critical piece of equipment there. So I was like, all right, well, all your heat's dissipating from the underneath the sealer because there's just air going between it. We need to put it back on the table, you know, avoid trying to make this pass through. Again, I understand where you guys are coming from. Maybe there's another method to streamline or the manufacturing process and the flow there. But we had to revalidate, write protocols, revalidate the sealer, do a full IQOQPQ within 3 days, because at the time it was holding up production. So I always encourage people to think of, you know, what would be the unintended consequences of even something as small as, hey, we're going to move the sealer from point A to point B. And even if you do, let's say that's one example, if you put it under air conditioner vent, your peel strength is going to go down because you got the cold air blowing down on the sealer there. You know, there's other pokey ways to make sure you maintain compliance. Another one is like a lockout of the sealing parameters. You know, maybe the line supervisor should only have the key and should only be able to update those parameters based on an SOP that's tied to a work order, whatever you're going to manufacture that day. But I think there's different ways to accomplish those. And there's just always keep in mind, give people the benefit of the doubt when these things pop up, and always make sure you want to go walk the floor, you want to go to Gamba, and you just want to trust but verify what they're saying so you could add to that and figure out a good corrective action to close that out and get it up and running again.
Yeah. Our equipment, we have a 4-digit password. So we have an admin area and then a user area, so they can't change validation parameters. We've also seen, you know, in the clean room, I mean, when we're doing validation, where we have it in a lab area, we have voltage that's applied. Maybe it's a very dedicated 20 amp circuit for that particular device. Then we move it into the clean room, and now it's on a, you know, 15 amp, and it's being shared by the copy machine that's on the other side of the clean room wall. So, you know, little things on the IQ checklist where they're going through and making sure that power, could it move? And if it does, what impact would that have? Is this a device that is a candidate to move without quality being involved? So I think a lot of those, sometimes I think in the packaging engineer side, is we get caught up in that perfect, pristine world where we're validating the equipment And we're not looking at the rough and tumbled reality. Once it gets into the clean room, we have a lot of different users, a different mental mindset. One's left-handed, one's right-handed, one has a bias for being rough on machines. One is too gentle. I mean, there's a lot of human constituents that come into play when we're looking at validation. So, you know, it's our job to be able to vet those out, to predict what's coming next. I mean, that's been my job as a quality manager at Vanderstall in our laboratory, is I'm trying to be more predictive with everything to be sure that I can sort of be Nostradamus when it comes to what may happen. You know, what is the tree, the path forward? Where could, what Tony Robbins used to call pre-problems. So where's the problem that could happen here, and trying to find those problems before they develop into an actual problem. Now, we got to visit the 1 pound thing. You and I have talked about this many times before, and you hinted to it just now. So we just have to talk about it. And, you know, it was funny. I was just in a meeting on a Teams meeting with a company looking for packaging equipment, and they were talking about their quality plan, and they said that they had the 1 pound peel. I started immediately. That's a red flag for me. And by the way, it's an audit red flag too. So I started asking questions, and this is one of those things that, you know, Jim worked for the last company, the company before, and Sally worked there too, and they both heard 1 pound, and it's become this crazy urban legend. And we've talked about it as it being kind of an urban legend.
Yeah.
It's got to drive you crazy too. You still see it, yeah?
Yeah. I mean, I make sure all my engineers, everybody's trained up and they understand what that 1 pound means. So here's a perfect story is, again, I was 2006. I was a senior engineer. 1 pound was already there. Nobody could tell me where it came from. I don't know if it was printed in the back of the Constitution or whatever. It just, nobody knows the existence or the origin of this 1 pound spec, at least that I could find out. So it was on all our drawings, all our procedures. Is basically, that's your minimum spec. Now, of course, the day came when we had an auditor and they said, well, could you tell me where this came from? And I opened and honestly, it's, I can't tell you where that came from, essentially. So part of that was, okay, that 1 pound spec, as you know, if you look at ASTM F88, it really tells you it's only good for in-process monitoring, because think about it this way, it's a 1 inch width sample of your sterile barrier system if you're using a pouch, even a tray. And if you get a channel in that tray, 100% channel in that tray, you lose sterile barrier integrity, but you can still maintain your minimum seal strength there. Mm-hmm. So it's not really a function of sterile barrier integrity, but just a function of your process and what the capability is of that process. What I ended up having to do is, all right, well, how do you demonstrate over time and all this other stuff that you have to address that 1 pound spec is going to be enough to maintain sterile barrier integrity through your supply chain into the point of use? And when I say a point of use, I mean like through aging, you know, stability, accelerated real-time aging, everything that goes along with that. What I ended up doing was, because I didn't have the data to demonstrate that. So I went ahead and did a quick mini DOE lab notebook feasibility study on the books and figured out a set of inputs that gave me a set of outputs, such as a minimum peel strength of 0.5 pound. My goal was to take the path of least resistance. So instead of updating, if you think bigger picture, updating all these procedures, drawings, all this time and effort it's going to take across multiple people to do this, let's just figure out if we can get it below 1 pound, maintain sterile barrier integrity at the end of the day. Mm. And that way you have data to prove it and you don't have to touch anything else on the back end. Mm. So it actually worked out. But here's the thing is, I repeated 13 validations. I did 13 verification studies.
Wow.
Different types of sterile barrier systems, sizes, worst case, everything that went along with that. It was a pretty lengthy report, but at the end of the day, the auditor understood what I was trying to do. They signed off on it in a sense, and we were able to remove that observation. And then obviously we put stuff in our procedures and processes moving forward that this wouldn't happen again. So, you know, that was the correct, it was a big corrective action and kappa associated with that. Yeah. But this is just it's a situation that I'm sure a lot of us walk into, packaging engineers, going, oh yeah, we got 1 pound on these, so we're okay. You know, our minimum spec on the sealer is 4 pounds. Mm. And if your minimum spec's 1 pound, how do you know what happens if your seal strength drops off and you have no data to prove that integrity piece through the supply chain?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, in our lab, in our empirical side, you know, we're looking at, just like you would look uniquely at each child. I have kids, and you know, each one gets sort of a different view or different parent, right? They you give them something different based on their uniqueness. That's how you manage kids, and that's how you manage processes, in my opinion. So in our laboratory, we're getting materials in, and there's a lot of unique materials that are coming in that we have to look at and find out what their capability is. So, you know, we typically will peel the manufacturer's seal with a goal of trying to meet or beat that by, say, 5 or 10%. So the problem is not taking into account what that material can be bonded at. You're just poking in the dark, and it really seems like an odd place to start for me. So we're trying to get the best seal strength that we can for that material, but each material has to be understood. So the best place for us to start, we don't want to be the Achilles heel. So we start poking around and finding out what the converter, how they do, and let's see how we can do on the machinery that we sell. So anyway, that's kind of our approach in our empirical lab. But obviously, having a lower value and understanding from that optic has value as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know what we do, because we don't have a lab such as yourself, but we get the data sheets, the material data sheets. We take a look at what the activation energy is. What's the recommended temperature? Because it could say, oh yeah, this is a great seal at 300 degrees. We all know you can't operate a sealer at 300 degrees. You'll burn it out and break it. It's not going to function. So that's really, you know, the key importance too is the design of experiments that really goes into that and figuring out that mix of inputs, like your time, temperature, pressure, that's going to equate to what you're looking for, that edge of failure that you're looking for. I can tell you when I used to train teams on process validations, what I ended up doing, which I learned from that 1 pound experience back in the day, you create your set of manufacturing sealing process parameters. You know, you include your alarm limits. I like to go at least a couple standard deviations out from those. So I have a nice safety window in case something does go south. Mm-hmm. But then I also create a set of DV low process parameters to seal my worst case samples at for performance testing and look at that. So it's way below that process, but I also do a lot of feasibility too to make sure, all right, is this really going to work, or are these seals just going to blow open? Am I wasting my time there? So I always recommend everybody kind of characterize your process, make sure you look at what's going to work, what's not going to work. And feasibility test is always going to be your best friend there.
You know, if you're a busy packaging engineer, there's always a temptation to try to find shortcuts. And I don't mean that in a bad way. We all have, you know, we have to monetize our devices. We have schedules and meetings and expectations. So I think you hit on something there. Is a lot of times we'll look at the manufacturer's data sheets for the material. And then we also do it as a machine provider. I can tell you what we'll get is someone who's transitioning from one of our competitors' machines, for instance, and saying, hey, you know, here's our parameters. We need to work in these. Well, can we take a peek at your material? Because, you know, you're talking about what is, you know, are you creating 100 newtons of force? How much force is being applied? What is the dynamics of the platen? What's the topography? What's the metallurgy? You know, so many things that have to come into play. So if you're just taking recommendations from converters or taking recommendations from machine providers, I think it's such a generic place to start, and you're going to end up redoing the work anyway. No one likes to do in-depth DOEs, but it's so important for you to get valuable data. So because we firewall our empirical lab with the machine sales part of our business, is we can take that in and we can do some evaluation and find out on our equipment with your material what those settings would be, so we can give them some nominal values that they can start. But at the end of the day, once we provide those numbers to them, the expectation from ISO and the FDA is going to still be, it's just like in college, you know, it's great, you show the answer. Now we want to see your work. How did you arrive at that answer? So I think that's where DOEs internally and not trying to make those shortcuts by asking vendors to do the work for you can go a long ways.
Absolutely. And I wish I would have done that too. Actually, never thought about it back then because I was going off the sheets and everything. But also keep in mind too, as you go through and you do your processing of the whole thing, you know, sterilization plays a big part of it as well. So when I did process validations, I would send samples out for, call it 2x ETL. It was a very conservative company, by the way, so I would go very conservative in my testing and DOEs for that, just to see what would happen during that process. Because a lot of the stressors, you know, vacuum, pressure, temperature, everything going into that aeration is going to impact your seals.
Right. Yeah. It's important to know those. Beyond destructive testing, which again, you know, we know that there's value there. Make sure that our processes are sound. We have some feedback metric that's closed and bracketed. Those are important. As we move into the 2019 iteration of 11607, we're talking more about seal integrity, talking about, you know, are the seals pretty? What do they aesthetically look like? Visual inspection, which has been kind of the stepchild for so long, is starting to get some street cred now. We make a visual inspection tool, and it just sort of sat on the shelf. It wasn't a big seller because no one wanted to believe that looking at a seal has value. But we're now beginning to see that, you know, the human eye connected with an enormous power of a mind, the human mind, we can discern a lot of different values. And by using keys, our company has a thing called the Seal Stats app. It's a iPhone app that has a lot of different seal, you know, failures. And you can take a picture on your phone and you can swipe left or right and you can compare what you're actually seeing on your seal with some known anomalies that are designed to kind of connect with the ASTM 1886 and also some lab discovered anomalies that we included as well. So even the nascent operator that isn't a high level trained, educated, degreed engineer still has that human mind, visual acuity to be able to look at a seal and say, hey, you know, this clearly isn't the 10 millimeter width that we were sealing. We can see foldovers, we can see fissures, we can see particulates. So are you starting to add more value into visual inspection? Seems to be what all the what everybody's doing right now.
Yeah, and this really goes along with ISO 11607, you know, parts one and two for the process piece of it. But when it comes to the visual inspection, you have to do seal width measurements. If you look at performance testing, stability, you look at the process validation piece of it, it is a requirement in there. And it's not just any requirements, making sure that, hey, if that's going to tell you if there's an issue with your sealing process, or if the, let's say if it's just a simple pouch on a sealer, a bar sealer, is not being sealed correctly, it's at an angle or it's folded over some of the material, you can see lines in it, it's not going to be a good seal there. So a lot of that, yeah, it's coming down to more visual inspections. What I've seen, because I'm a little far removed at this point, but haven't really seen too many destructive tests other than the peel test or maybe even burst test if people do that in-house. Definitely the peel strength testing is going to be that. And then also a way to double up on it too is if you take your peel test samples, once you peel them, then you just measure the seal transfer and see if that still meets your minimum seal with specification.
Yeah. What we do, you know, we kind of have this triad approach. We have a machine, it's called the PTT-100, and it's a horizontal peel tester that also incorporates a visual inspection system on it as well. And then we throw in a pre-mixed die pin kit. So, you know, you're able to do die pin. I mean, die pin has been really valuable for people to really get an idea of sort of width loss on their seal. Mm-hmm. Sometimes visually it can be difficult to see even through a loop. It doesn't really, depending on the material, particularly on a dual substrate film, it doesn't show up quite as well. So again, talking about some testing metrics getting kind of a bad rap, visual inspection, because it really wasn't done per the 1886 standard, which, you know, I don't think you have to necessarily do that and still have a good process, but you do have to have a few ingredients in order to make that a valuable test. And we don't want variability. And I think that's one of the problems. I mean, we would do visual inspection and people would write off on a simple written out log. How does the seal look to you? It looks okay to me. What is the visual, you know, contact with how many, what is the times of magnification? Are you using incandescent light? Using, you know, balanced, you know, high Kelvin, 5,800 Kelvin, you know, balanced daylight sort of light. So there was a lot of different lighting sources that people were using. They were looking under a microscope, which really isn't a good way to go because it doesn't give you more of the scope. It just shows it too close. So, you know, when we develop one that's 3x magnification, it conforms to the light source that the 1886 spells out. So if you're doing it right and, you know, you can in-service somebody on this with that reference card in 15 or 20 minutes to really get them to understand what you're looking for, and visual inspection has been shown to really be a good sort of look into what might be happening. You can sometimes see sealing machine failures, obviously, that you couldn't necessarily, and you alluded to it a minute ago, not necessarily see through a peel test. You can have a destructive test where it passes, and yet you had a hole in your seal, right? That's one of the problems.
Right,
with it,
right. You know? Yeah, it's definitely interesting. I always incorporated visual inspection in my test samples too. So as we went through and you do all the, you know, I call it conditioning, simulated distribution testing, thermal conditioning, whatever, sterilization. Once we go to remove those sterilizer systems from the protective packaging, like the cartons and the shippers, we do a full-blown F-1886 visual inspection on it, just to document observations. Like, it could be maybe there's some cracking, maybe there's a bit of a seal lift or peel from the inside out, mm-hmm. but we just want to document and denote the location and everything in case it does end up failing under an approved study. And we use that information to do a root cause analysis and do a corrective action if we need to go down that path.
I think, you know, there really isn't the sort of silver bullet in terms of pouch testing. You need to overlay several different modalities and see exactly which one, because again, one will interrupt the other. Yep. So it's good to have many things in the toolkit. I think, you know, when we're getting beat up a lot of times through throughput, we're trying to get as much parts out the back door into the brown truck on its way to the hospital, the sterilizer. But, you know, we have to slow down a little bit to keep us out of trouble. And so we need to kind of manage and minify some of these testing modalities to be able to do them quickly and easily so they're less painful. But, you know, we've told this a million times. I mean, doing the peel testing and some of the other tests that you do, it's sort of like Lisa here always tells customers, she says, it's like the insurance contract at the rental car desk. You opt out of it and it was the greatest decision you ever made, unless you get into a wreck and now you got to pay an $8,000 gap. So it's one of those things where it makes perfect sense in the event of a product recall, or you're on the other end of a 43 or a concern where you're trying to bracket what exactly is going on. And it keeps you honest and makes sure that you're not, before those parts ever leave the facility, you have already done some evaluation, usually one of all of these metrics, and have that feedback to say, hey, you know, on June 4th at 2:00, we did a peel test. We also did a visual inspection later that day. And so you have a picture of the journey of that pouch and through your packaging. Mm-hmm. I mean, we have so many, I'm a certified 17025 auditor. And so a lot of times I'm the one that's talking to the auditors when they're one of our customers having an audit or an issue. And they're, you know, looking down the barrels of a cap and they're trying to make sense of everything. And we're always so surprised to find out over a course of 6 months or a year, they have really nothing to hang their hat on. There's no data that they can pull up on their computer and say, hey, look, here's what we were doing. It just is a surprising to me that even though you've made this magnum opus of validation, it's beautiful. It's like your screensaver on your computer. It's so well done. But then you believe, you know, it's like you've been saying, trust but verify. You believe that all the stars are going to line up and that validation that you created in that laboratory and that you put in place is going to maintain its value through the arc of that 12-month period. And that's a lot of hope and nascent belief, I think, at that point. You really have to constantly be having something to bracket these events to make sure that you're out of trouble.
Yeah. And I always tell everybody, like, if you didn't document it, it never happened. You never did it. And that's really what we're looking for here. I could write a 5-page report on a process validation, but it would probably have 300 pages of attachments and data associated with it.
Exactly.
And it's tedious. I get that. But that's what we do as package engineers, right? Like, we want to make sure we have our I's dotted and our T's crossed. And when it comes down to it, anybody at any point in time, whether you're with the company or no longer there, that validation stands the test of time. They don't need to ask the originator questions on that. And I've been in those situations too, just trying to figure out, reverse engineer and see what's going on. But yeah, definitely bracketing is helpful. You don't need to test it like 700 product families. Take a look, systematically go through, create your solid technical justifications in there and why you're doing, you know, maybe it's all the same material. It's just different size sterile barrier systems. This is worst case because there's more variability, because there's more surface area, or it's a longer made manufacturing seal that's being done. So there's ways to do that. So you don't have to go through like a million test samples. It can be very resource friendly as you systematically figure out what that justification is and what your sample size justification is that's associated with that.
Yeah, that's right. I've got to get back on here. I want to talk about sample size. That's a whole other discussion that I want to have with you, because we have so many different beliefs on that. Mathematics, whatever, it's moved into philosophy sometimes when we're looking at sample sizes. So love to get you back on. And then, well, any closing sort of thoughts, Lon, before we turn you loose here? I mean, there's so much I want to cover with you. You're such a bright guy, and I always enjoy, this is, I think, maybe your second or third time on. I can't remember. I don't remember yeah, things. My 65th yeah. birthday is this Saturday, so I don't remember things like I used to.
well, happy birthday.
No, thank you. We'll definitely pick this back up, and I do want to talk about sampling. But before I let you go, any sort of closing thoughts for packaging engineers to help them down this journey?
Yeah, I guess just a couple, and I kind of said it. So my mentor was a VP of quality at one of my companies that I worked for. It kind of took me under his wing. I will say, if you never documented it, it never happened. So just keep that in mind. You know, make sure that you document what you need to do for any validations, any feasibility testing, because it will come back down the road. It will be looked at and reviewed. And then, you know, for all the package engineers out there, and something that I used to kind of coach my department as well, is not everything we do is going to be comfortable. And there's going to be scenarios where it's going to be very uncomfortable. But I will say, your biggest growth in your career, and maybe even personally, is be comfortable with being uncomfortable and take some risks there. That's really how you grow from a lot of the stuff that we kind of see that's happening these days.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. I think people tend to rest on their laurels sometimes. And, you know, I think I'm happiest, and I think it's kind of the human condition when we have, you know, trouble, depending, hopefully it's not too big a trouble, but trouble alone. I mean, we tend to grow from problems, right? I mean, that's the human condition. Yeah. And if we always say that, you know, fish, if they don't have a current to swim against, then they perish. We need some sort of grist in the mill a little bit to drive us. And I think it does. It's, as you say, not only in your own career growth, but personal growth, to have a little bit of pushback and champion those and go into the next one. That's how we gain our confidence. And that's how we become better engineers and humans, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, thanks so much, Lon, for hanging out with me today. I look forward to our next conversation. And of course, look forward to seeing you back at the MD&M when we're hanging out at the Medical Device Packaging Technical Committee, where we're all bellied up to the bar over there. And I have
talk.
Yeah, we can finally talk. Usually you're over there sauntering with somebody, and you're a high demand guy. So everybody's gathering around you. So by the time I got to get out the door for a meeting or something, I only get to say hi to you. So hopefully we can spend a little bit more time together in February. And I guess I missed you also. You were out at the Packout this year as well. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I was at the Packout, the second one this year, second one since inception last year. And I thought it was great. It's just really cool to see everybody, common goals between package engineers and just sharing of information and technical information and just really camaraderie and helping each other out. So I thought that was great. And Charlie, as always, I appreciate you having me on the show too, on the podcast. So thank you for that.
Absolutely. Yeah. I had FOMO so bad. I had a meeting in Nashville that was at the same dates. And so for the second year in a row, I wasn't able to make it to the Packout. Great event, nothing but praise for that event. And I'm going to be there come, you know, hell or high water this next go around. I've made myself clear the path to make sure I'm there. So hopefully I'll see you at Packout as well. Thanks a lot for hanging out with me, and look forward to talking to you on our next meeting.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Charlie. Take care.
Well, Lon, as usual, it's been such a great pleasure to have you on Spot Radio today. I love our discussion that we continue to bring to the forefront about the 1 pound urban legend. It's always a kick having that conversation. Well, if I don't talk to you before then, I guess we'll meet up at the Cool Kids table out in Anaheim at the Marriott during the Medical Device Packaging Technical Committee's little meetup that we do with the MD&M. It's always a pleasure to catch up with everybody. We finally get a lot of us in medical device packaging under one roof, and we get to, you know, sort of kick our shoes off a little bit and chat and get to know each other. It's been so fun. I really enjoyed that. So thanks again for hanging out with me today. I always appreciate your insight. And, you know, thanks so much for all the things that you do, your contributions at Network Partners and your personal contributions. It does not go unrecognized. Well, whatever platform you're listening to this podcast today, you can get Lon's contact information there. So medical device manufacturers, medical device packaging professionals, as always, thanks so much for hanging out here with me on Sterile Packaging on Track Radio, Spot Radio. This is Charlie Webb. Look forward to having you back on the next one.
This podcast is made possible by Vanderstall Scientific. Executive producer Lisa Wasper. Director of Media Service Hector Garcia. Audio engineering and editing by Joel and our friends at East Coast Studios. And this is Jonathan Lockwood saying thanks for your support, medical device manufacturers. See you next time on Spot Radio.